Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, Kirk Harnack, Chris Tobin's along, and we've got this guy, Denny Sanders. He was doing rock and roll music and blowing up processors, weren't you?
Yes, I was.
All right, we got stories for you and a little bit of interesting information about processing, all coming up on This Week in Radio Tech. TWRT is brought to you by Lavo and the Crystal Clear Virtual Radio Console. Crystal Clear is the console with a multi-touch touchscreen interface. And by Axia Audio and the full line of Axia networked IP audio consoles with LiveWire Plus, giving you full compliance AES-67 networked audio. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack. Glad that you're here. And I'm not in my usual man cave. I'm somewhere else. This is the show where we talk about radio technology, audio, RF, streaming, all these things that work together to bring audio entertainment to listeners. And that's everything from the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower or the data going out over the internet. So we do this every week, every Thursday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on the GFQ Network. And if you've not tuned in live, if you're watching a repeat, you can catch it live at GFQLive.tv. That's Thursdays at 5 p.m. And, of course, they're all archived on YouTube, and you can see them on the GFQ Network site as well as thisweekinradiotech.com. So that's enough for the beginning. I'm Kirk. I am the host of the show. And for the next hour, we're going to be talking with this guy right here, Denny Sanders. I'll introduce him in just a sec, but we always bring in our report from the Big Apple. It's Chris Tobin. Hey, Chris, welcome in.
Hello, Kirk. Hello, Denny. I'm in the city of brotherly love, Philadelphia.
What?
I'm doing a double duty, doing our netcast and also doing a video netcast for a local broadcast operation. So, in a sports bar, where else to do a great video event?
Do you appear from anywhere else? I mean, this is what week seven of the sports bar. You've been banished from the sports bar.
This particular show has broadcasts from the. Let's see, there's 22 locations for this sports bar chain, and I think I've done, 13 of them so far. So it's been pretty good. It's an interesting concept that they're doing, and a friend of mine has a company that I'm working with, and we're introducing some new stuff, and actually in Radio World International, there was an article about a radio station doing video, so we should talk about that later.
Well, yeah, let me ask you, now don't give the complete answer, but do you or do you not have a really weird or interesting internet connection set up this week?
Oh, no, I know, you're grasping at that, this...
the ketchup bottle?
The ketchup bottle. No, today it's just strictly Wi-Fi on my laptop.
Okay.
But the Wi-Fi, I did a speed test, and the downlink is running at 35 megabits. The up is 25. So far, so good.
Yeah. Well, so if you're just tuned in and you wonder what I'm trying to egg Chris on about, the ketchup bottle internet connection, and you'd have to go back a couple of episodes, maybe three or four episodes of This Week in Radio Tech to catch that. To catch up that.
It's a perfect reflector for a 5.8 gig Wi-Fi antenna attachment. That's all I'll tell you. You'll have to go back to the episode.
And if the ketchup bottle is full of ketchup, it's pretty stable, too.
It's very stable. Actually, it's handy when you're in a sports bar environment. You want something very stable for your antenna.
Exactly. The Worcestershire bottles, not so much. They're too skinny.
No, that didn't have enough girth or weight.
But yeah, and the martini glasses.
No. No, they get in the way of the drinking. You don't want to do that. You're at a sports bar. You're not supposed to get in the way of the drinking. Besides, the 57 varieties, has it got enough weight and girth to make it just right? As the picture shows in the video, you can always watch.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and bring our guest in here. I'm sitting at the Telus Alliance headquarters in Cleveland, Ohio, and this guy here, Denny Sanders. Hello, Denny. Welcome in.
I know you.
Denny was my boss for years, and we got along well then, and we get along well now. And tell you what, we're going to keep our powder dry for a second here. We got one commercial to do and get right into it, but let's do a little tease.
Okay.
We have engineers and program directors watching the show, mostly engineers. You were a program director at a really big and famous radio station here in Cleveland. And before that, you were in the rock and roll era on the radio, but you always had an interest in audio processing to make sure your station sounded really good.
Oh, sure.
And we're going to talk about that, yeah?
Yes, we are. We have
a really interesting story about a person that I used to work with back in the old days at WMMS who knew a little something about audio processing.
But even before that, I got to believe that you and audio processing made some iterative rounds in the world of rock and roll radio, and I think some pretty important stuff happened. And the statute of limitations has run out, so there's a lot you can say now.
That's what you think.
All right, this week in Radio Tech with Denny Sanders. He is what do you have a title nowadays? I don't really. Do you?
Chief Company Strategist, I guess, which means they haul me into any project that they want to.
Does anybody know how to do this? No, let's get Denny a look at it.
Yeah, that's so, right.
Well, Denny does talk to a lot of radio stations about audio processing. He's been in that for years. He's a member of the Ohio Broadcasting Hall of Fame. Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah, I am. So, yeah, okay. We're in rarefied air right here. Hey, so stick around. It's coming up. Our show is brought to you in part by the folks at Lavo. They've been a sponsor for about a year now. And most of you know me as a broadcast engineer, on-air guy, host of this show, This Week in Radio Tech. What you may not know is that I've also sold broadcast equipment internationally. Denny sent me out on a few of those trips. The job took me all around the world, and I've seen a lot of broadcasting in a lot of different countries and different, sometimes imaginative ways that people do things pretty fascinatingly. That's one of the reasons I'm excited to introduce you to our sponsor, Lavo. That's L-A-W-O. And their website is lawo.com. Lavo's famous around the world for television, audio, and video, especially for high-profile event coverage like the Olympics and World Cup soccer and the Grammy Awards. Well, when the broadcast is mission-critical, you're pretty likely to find a Lavo console there. You wouldn't believe how this stuff is built. Everything is really over-engineered, redundant. Even some of their backups have backups, because there are no do-overs in live event broadcasting, and dead air in that kind of situation, well, that'll kill your career. Now, you may be thinking, why should I care? I'm not doing TV. Well, radio guys hate dead air even more than TV guys, because, you know, dead air, I mean, air is what we sell, which is why broadcasters like NPR, CBC, the BBC, to name a few, buy and use Lavo radio consoles. Being this involved in TV and radio all around the world means that Lavo thinks about the future a lot, too. So we know that all types of media are converging on a common IP delivery platform, and Lavo is ready for it with broadcast gear that can handle audio, video, and control of every studio device using a single, integrated, commercial, off-the-shelf computer network. And after that, well, hey, here comes virtualization and broadcasting from the cloud. Lavo's already building the tools for that as well. So if absolute bulletproof reliability, 99.9s of uptime, and being future-proof are important to you, well, you do owe it to yourself to find out more about Lavo. Go to lavo.com/twert. Please add the twert on there. That gives us a little bit of credit. L-A-W-O, lavo.com/T-W-I-R-T to find out more. Thanks a lot, Lavo, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. All right, Chris Tobin's along. He's been in New York radio for a while, and so he's dealing with rock and roll, well, I mean, a madhouse of processing there. But let's talk about in the early days when you were getting going in rock and roll radio. Was this in the Boston area?
Well, I started in 1968 on the MIT FM station, which was called WTBS in those days. Now, I wasn't smart enough to go to MIT, but they allowed a certain amount of non-students to appear on the air and do a show. Okay. And I knew a little bit about the music, so they let me on, and that was fun. And later came to Cleveland in 1971, where I spent 15 years at WMMS. I was the original program director. Later gave it up to be on the air full-time. And then after I left WMMS, I went to WMJI across town.
Ah, yeah, Magic.
Yeah, and was there for nearly another 15 years, and then came here in 2001. And as far as audio processing goes, in the early days at WMMS, we were using, I seem to remember, the white CBS Volumax. And we had, at one point, Jim Somich was the chief engineer who was...
Oh, at MMS here in Cleveland?
Yes, at MMS. Yeah. And he was brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
He did some custom hot rod on the Volumax and some other things. And then we got this other guy that came in.
Oh, yeah. We'll move to him in a minute. I want to bring Chris in because you mentioned, and I know memory from 68 may be a little fuzzy. It certainly has been for me. I remember starting in radio, and my mic processor was a Shure Level Lock. That thing would grab the back of your throat and just pull it out of your mouth and shove it to the top of the tower.
Well, I'll tell you something about WTBS. It's called WMBR now. They sold the call letters to Ted Turner,
Turner
for a pretty hefty amount of money. And the control room, both control rooms, as a matter of fact, at WTBS, had the first transistorized control boards.
Oh.
Even before there were commercial solid-state control boards.
Wait a minute. Was this the board built by a guy we know?
Barry Blesser.
What?
Yes.
Barry Blesser, MIT grad, PhD. He works for us. Yep. He works with the TELUS Alliance. And he built the console you used?
He built the console that I used at WTBS. And as a matter of fact, he doesn't remember this, but he was long out of MIT in those days. And he came by the station one day, and I said hello and shook his hand, this and that. And it's funny how many, many, many years later, Circle comes around again, and he's working in our organization. Isn't that funny?
Wow. Dr. Barry Blesser wrote a book about acoustics, and it's very interesting. I've got a copy of that. You can get that on Amazon. Get it for your Kindle.
I'll tell you one more thing.
Yeah.
At WTBS, we had the prototypes of the original Bose direct reflective speakers.
Oh,
Dr.
Okay.
Bose hadn't yet put them out on the commercial market, or they were just coming out. I forgot.
Yeah.
And we had the prototypes that were hanging up in the control room. It was an amazing station.
Well, I guess you could expect things like that to happen at MIT.
Sure.
So you mentioned early on these an Automax and a Volumax with a white face, and I kind of recall that as well at a couple of AM stations that I worked at. Chris Tobin, what's the oldest audio processor you think you've ever seen or dealt with?
The Gates Level Devil. I've worked with that. The Automax, Volumax. And there was a couple of others that I came across, but those are the ones that come to mind.
Oh, yeah. Now, and I hope I'm correct in remembering. Now, was this the one rack unit, or the bigger two rack unit box?
I think it was the two, if I remember correctly.
I worked with the two.
Yeah,
I worked with the two.
I must work with the later ones. I worked with the one RUs that were totally solid state. I think the two rack unit ones, didn't they have a new Vistor in them as one of the control elements?
I believe that's correct.
Yeah. Wow. So at the MIT station.
Yeah.
What kind of programming were you playing there?
Well, I was playing a freeform album rock program.
Okay.
This was in 1968, and WBCN had just gone full time. That was the commercial station
in
Boston that survived for many years. And some of the MIT people went over there. I was too young, so I couldn't do it. I was still in high school in 68, senior in high school, so I couldn't go over full time. But I did some part time stuff on BCN and then eventually came to Cleveland in 71.
Okay. So coming to Cleveland in 71, did you first come to MMS?
Yes, that's where I was hired for.
Now, even as I first heard of MMS living in Kentucky, going to high school, and I heard about this legendary rock station. Now, we had a pretty good rock station in Kentucky. We had 98 Rock Double Q, WKQQ, covered a huge area, it was on 100,000 watt at the time, and a huge area. That was really my introduction to FM rock radio. But this was when I was in high school in the late 70s.
Mm-hmm.
So how would I have heard of MMS? How would the reputation have reached me in Kentucky at that point? Any idea?
Well, it was a pretty unique station in the sense where we had a way of being cutting edge and commercial at the same time. That's a neat trick.
Oh.
You're really walking a tightrope. So we were adventurous enough to become famous and break new records. We broke Heart. We broke Rush. We were the first station west of New York City to play Bruce Springsteen.
Mm-hmm.
We broke dozens of other acts, Tom Petty, I can't even think of all of the acts, David Bowie, many, many acts we first played. So that was the cutting edge of the station, that we were not afraid to go on these new and unknown artists. And on the other hand, to balance it and to be a commercial station, we knew how many hits we had to play. And in those days, you seemed to have an either-or situation. You either had a free-form station that was just as open as you could be, mm-hmm. or you had kind of the ABC-FM format, which was just hit tracks. And we ran it right down the middle, and we became famous in that way.
Okay. I recall Double Q in Lexington doing that, too. There'd be some hits, and then there'd be some breaking artists or deep album cuts, I guess.
You got to know how to do it.
Yeah.
We
got an Omni 11 behind us here, and it does have a screensaver, so I just knocked it back on there. So you mentioned Jim Somich. Now, mm-hmm. Jim has since passed away, just 3-4 years ago or so, maybe?
Yeah, about that. Mm-hmm.
And I always wanted to have Jim on the show, but that was early in the show. And actually, I was scared to call him and say, would you be on my show? Because I had heard so much about Jim, but he took care of your audio processing at MMS in those early days, yeah?
Yeah, in not quite the early days. The station was originally owned by Metro Media.
Ah.
It was the lowest of the Metro Media stations. And about 6 months after I got there, they sold it to another group. And Jim was in there someplace, I think 74 or 75, okay. someplace in there for a little while. And terrific, brilliant engineer.
Well, mostly what I know about Jim is he designed a composite clipper. And with FM processing, and I know we have some viewers and listeners who may be new to engineering or not know some of the techniques that are used with FM, but it's possible to clip what we call the composite or the multiplex signal to clip that. And the only problem is when you clip that, it makes a lot of grunge and dirt in that spectrum, in that baseband spectrum. But Jim Somich, had some very clever ways of making a composite clipper. That was pretty effective, and he sold a number of his boxes. Chris Tobin, here in the New York market, where it's got to be loud or it's not on the air. Do you recall having any of these Jim Somich boxes there?
Yes. Okay. We had a couple of them along with the other guys, that other CP box. Yeah.
The CP-803.
Yeah, New York City, you have anything that can make something loud, and then that's pretty much it. You come into the door, and if you can prove 2 to 3 dB of loudness, all right, let's talk. If you can't, get out. So yeah, well, the guys that guy at your place that knows about that. I think it was the Gorilla Building they used to use.
I want to talk to Denny a bit more about MMS. What was the mascot?
Oh, it was the Buzzard.
The Buzzard, yes.
Yeah, and it still is. The people that are carrying on the station still use it as a mascot. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, I've seen some YouTube videos of you on the air.
Oh, God help you.
No, they're great. They're great. I mean, this was rock radio in the, mid-70s probably?
I don't know quite what's up there. People have told me it spans early stuff from the 70s and then later on in the 80s too. Art Volo shot some of that stuff. God bless him.
Yeah,
The man with the camera attached to his hip, at all times.
So was MMS known for its strong or loud audio processing as well as the taste-making music?
Well, it was known as a very good tech station in many ways. I guess we can reveal some of the surprise of the other gentleman I was working with. But when we moved up to the Statler office tower, in 1977, they re-outfitted the studio.
Statler's, that's a hotel?
It was a hotel at one point. Okay. Now it's partly office tower and some hotel.
But it's just a couple blocks away, isn't
it? Yeah, at 12th Street. And we were up on the 12th floor, and 1977, and they built a new studio, and they were very, very careful. In those days, of course, we had turntables, and they were dampened perfectly so you didn't hear the rumble, mm-hmm. and we could really get a bottom end out of that station without worrying about turntable rumble. That was a lot of what we were concerned about in those days. Seems quaint today. And wonderfully designed. And so we needed a new chief engineer at one point, and I believe it was about 1979 mm-hmm. that we placed an ad looking for a new chief engineer. And this kid waltzed into the station.
And at the Statler office tower.
Mm-hmm, yep, okay. At the Statler office tower.
All right.
And it was this young kid, and he was working over at WELW, which was an AM suburban 500-watt little station. And he came in, and he was a fan of the station and was full of energy and full of determination, and he was hired. And he was amazing. His name was Frank Foti.
Mm.
And
long hair.
Yeah, quite long hair. And a lot skinnier in those days, I remember. But that
probably had some attitude about him, too.
Weren't we all? Weren't we all skinnier in those days? But at one point, for many years, I did the night show.
Okay, yeah.
And Frank used to come in the evening, and I was a bit of an audio finicky audio guy. I would listen at home and always say, wait a minute, that doesn't sound right, or this is out of phase, or this is I was the audio freak of the station. And Frank would come in at night, and he would have these breadboard projects that he was working on and these other things, and he would say, we'd monitor off air, and he'd say, how about this? And I said, oh, that's great, can you make it all right, how about this, how about that? And we'd kind of you know, he was the genius behind making this sound great. Well, anyway, it got to the point where there was all kinds of homebrew, special, custom Frank Foti gear that was we were processing with. And one story I can tell you is that we were pretty tight with Bob Seger in those days. He was only up in Detroit.
Oh, yeah.
And he used
to
come down Cleveland a lot, and he became a friend of the station.
Okay.
So he came up to the Statler, and this is after Frank was doing a lot of his magic, and I had him on air doing an interview with him. And, of course, we're monitoring off the air, and I played something, forget what it was, that he made. And he said, wow, I've never heard it sound that good.
This is Bob Seger.
This is Bob Seger. And he says, what are you doing? And I said, well, you know, we got a good guy that knows what he's doing here. And so that was helped to market the station. It wasn't just our programming. We were the loudest, cleanest thing on the dial.
Yeah.
We blew all of our competition away in terms of cleanness, in terms of loudness, even back then, and we're talking circa 79, 80, 81, when maybe people weren't paying so much attention to that sort of thing, and our competitors were driven insane because you'd punch buttons and we would come roaring out of the dial with a beautiful, clean sound, and they would try to catch us by cranking up the compression, and eventually it sounded like an accordion the competition was doing.
Well, they didn't have the tools. They didn't have Frank Foti.
Yeah, exactly. They didn't know what to do, so that was their problem.
So in a few minutes, we're going to fast forward to some modern times, because you're in touch with a lot of program directors around the country, and you know, they've got to be competitive, and you help them with that.
Do you have 1 minute?
Well, sure.
All right. Yeah. I'll tell you one other linking story to this. Frank, of course, did wonders with WMMS, and then Mallright Communications, which owned the station, got the WVNJ license in Newark and moved it to the Empire, and that became Z100.
Right.
So, of course, Frank became their chief engineer, and we needed a new chief engineer.
Okay.
So this guy from Indianapolis shows up, and he was pretty good with audio processing, but his specialty was phones. He hated the way phones sounded on the air. And he came in, and we hired him, and his name was Steve Church. Now,
I didn't realize that Steve followed Frank at
WMMS.
Okay.
At WMMS. Right. And you know, you want to talk about a top-sounding tech radio station.
Uh-huh.
Frank Foti and Steve Church. And Frank cleaned up the audio.
Yeah.
And Steve cleaned up the phones.
Can you imagine running a radio station in, this would have been, what, in the early 80s?
Frank was there from 79 to 83, I think. Yeah, and then Steve came in.
Okay, but can you imagine running a radio station? And this is when I was cutting my teeth at Double Q in Lexington. I was several years behind Steve and Frank, and in a much smaller market, too.
Mm.
Can you imagine having these two guys to be your engineers, if not at the same time, one right after the other?
Oh, God. Like I say, Frank cleaned up the audio beautifully, and then Steve comes in and completely cleans up the phones. And we had talk stations that would come into town, and they would say, God, your phone calls sound so good. How do you do it? And I remember Steve sometime later when he left the station and we all left the station.
Mm-hmm.
He said to me, you think there's a business in this?
And here we sit. Oh, my goodness. Wow. Chris, I don't mean to leave you out of the conversation. Anything that you want to jump in and add at this point? And then I've got
No, that's perfect. That's a great story. It's a great lineage. I can at least say that my experience with the names that have been thrown out on this netcast with Frank in New York City, 1984, Z100, yes. And he took what he did in Cleveland and brought it to New York and also stunned those folks, the other programmers across town, Larry Booger and the gang. And I must say that the rest is history. It's never changed since. It's been great, and I have the pleasure of at least working with a few of the folks that he worked that worked under him. So I have to say I've learned a lot from Steve and from Frank over the years. So I have to congratulate Denny on being able to work with a group of people that just, you know what, you got it in the right time. Everything was perfect, and you know, those are the days I miss.
Listen, he made us, both of those guys made us all look good.
Ah,
really?
Yeah. So I want to tell a little story just from 10 years ago. So 10 years ago, at that moment, I think you were managing director of this place. Mm-hmm. You were kind of running the shop for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I breezed into town one night, flew up from Nashville or wherever I was living at the time, and I was staying over here at the Embassy Suites, which is no longer Embassy Suites. And I come in, it's 11 o'clock at night, and I'm hungry. I haven't had any dinner. And the guy said, well, the only place to eat is this wing and beer bar right next door. I said, well, okay. Wings and beer aren't my thing, but okay. Is there a sushi place around? No sushi place. Okay. So I go to the wing and bar. So I sit down at the bar, and there's some loud rock music playing and some dangerous-looking people playing pool. And so it's not my crowd. So I'm sitting down there at the bar, and this woman sits down right around the corner of the bar from me. And she wants to strike up a conversation. So, hi, how you doing? Fine, blah, blah, blah. What are you in town for? Oh, I work for this company called Telos. Okay. So, yeah, I'm here to see my boss, Denny. She says, Denny? Denny, I only know one guy named Denny. I said, Denny Sanders. She says, oh, my God, you work for Denny Sanders.
God.
So, I said, yeah, why? She says, well, I love and hate that man. I said, well, is this an ex-wife or something?
Whoa.
So, I said, well, okay. What's the story? She says, well, I was a disc jockey on another station. I forget which one she said. I was on the air on another station, at least during part of your career. And she said, he was my direct competition. Couldn't beat him. Everybody was listening to Denny, and I had a really hard time getting an audience. She said the best times were when Denny was on vacation or somebody was filling in for him. Then I had a chance.
Well, she's a sweetheart. That's right.
So you have used this word on me before called tastemaker.
Oh.
And yeah, that part of what you did as a program and music director was being a tastemaker, to picking the things that you think your audience will respond to favorably and dramatically, that they're going to like this music, this song, this act. And not only with music, but also with audio processing. I know you worked and gave your opinion on the processing. Mm-hmm. Tell me a bit about taste making in the mass media radio business. Give me your thoughts on that.
Well, in those days at MMS, and we're talking about the mid to late 70s and early to mid 80s, which was the real golden days of the station, about 75 to 85,
mm-hmm.
where we had just total dominance in the Cleveland market. We had ratings that nobody has gotten anywhere near since. And you can't expect them to. There was no cable television in those days. It was starting, but not widespread. Yeah. There was a little home video, but the machines were expensive. There was no internet. And we were it. We were the only connection that post-war baby boomers had with what was going on culturally.
Wow.
One thing I can tell you that would never happen today, and that is in 1977 when Elvis Presley died,
mm-hmm.
one thing that I remember was I put on the nightly news and there was David Brinkley.
Right.
And of course, it was the lead story on the NBC Nightly News. And he came on and he said, Elvis Presley, the singer, died today. He had to say the singer because the generations that were controlling the mass media, they felt that they had to explain who a rock and roll star was to the even somebody like Elvis. Now, today, if you when you put on CNN or you know, CBS or Fox or any of the news services, when Prince died,
right.
nobody had to say Prince the singer
right.
died.
Or Michael Jackson, the singer. Jackson, and there are other Michael Jacksons that are famous.
Right.
But nobody had to say Michael.
Because our generation had by this time become the generation that controlled the media.
Yeah.
But we didn't in those days. We didn't yet. And so MMS was the around the edges station that everybody listened to in Cleveland, and we were very proud of that.
Wow. So,
and the taste-making quickly the fact that all of the jocks on the station, and it wasn't just MMS, many album stations were this way as well, the DJs on air knew the music, loved the music, knew who the acts were, knew about the acts, and if any one of the acts just out of the blue walked into the studio, mm-hmm. they could do an interview with them without any prep because they knew about them.
Sure.
That's all gone. Today you have on-air performers that aren't necessarily tied to the music.
Right.
But maybe they don't have to be because today you have RDS. Today you have an internet readout of what's being played.
Right.
You have all the information in front of you. But back then, the only way they got it was the guy on mic.
I imagine you and a lot of your contemporaries on the air read the liner notes to see who played sax on this piece or who was the drummer or who arranged this this particular song.
You read the liner notes and you read all kinds of rock and roll magazines, you know, New Music Express, I remember, out of England we used to read a lot.
Yeah.
And you just kind of knew about the acts. It was part of your DNA. And again, today, you know, it's different. You can, a station plays a song, you go on the website, you see what it is, you can hit a button and immediately get the bio, you can buy the song, you can see where they're touring, all of this. None of that existed back then. You had to say it all on mic.
We're going to fast forward and by the way, just a programming note, I was going to save our last sponsor message for a little bit later in the show, if that's okay if everybody, so probably another 15 minutes or so. We're going to keep this train rolling. We'll fast forward now to more modern times.
Mm-hmm.
You have been recognized by people in our company and because you know other program directors around the country as someone who can give good advice and encouragement to program directors about how to make their station sound better. Mm-hmm. Of course, you work for the TELUS Alliance, so we're talking about Omnia Audio Processing. What is you talk to a program director who says, you know, Denny, I'm really having a problem with a couple competitors, and we just need to sound a little better.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, nowadays, audio program chains are usually pretty good. You know, 20 years ago, you'd have to go fix capacitors and you'd have bad transistors and you'd have some transformers that maybe needed to come out of the circuit. You had things that you needed to improve all along the way. Mm. With digital systems nowadays, I mean, if somebody puts in an audio over IP system, unless there's something grossly wrong, the audio coming out of that is going to be just about perfect. So what I'm saying is that the audio quality in the chain up to the processor is much more a given nowadays than it was 20 years ago, given that it's going to be good. Mm. Not guaranteed, but there's a lot less to worry about if you've got the digital stuff right. Now, so my point there is nowadays your audio processor, how it's adjusted, and maybe a little bit of still about the design of the transmitter and the exciter, that is where your key improvements come. And yeah, for you RF engineers, I know there's things that you can mess up the tuning of a transmitter, or your antenna can be bad, or the combiner can cause you problems as well. But for the most part, by and large, probably 90% of your sound is controlled by the audio processor. So what do you typically, how's a conversation with a program director go when you're talking to them?
The first question is, what is your source material?
Oh, that's still a question.
That
yeah,
is, absolutely. Say, yeah. Okay, yeah. Because if you are playing badly mastered source material, mm-hmm. or oh my gosh, believe it or not, they're not so much today, but as recently as, oh, I don't know, 3-4 years ago, some stations were still playing music on CART.
What?
Yes, believe it or not. And I would say, what is your source material? And they said, well, we're playing some from CD, and then there's some stuff we couldn't get the CD on, so we're playing CART. Now, these are oldie stations. These aren't current stations. Okay. Current stations, of course, have all the new media. Yeah. But, you know, if they're a legacy oldie station, especially some of these AMs, small town stations, they're playing from CART, and they're playing from God knows what. And, you know, I say, you've got to do something about this source material. It's mm-hmm. no good. And even when you play, when I was at MJI, just as I was leaving, we got into the Prophet system where we had files that we were playing. But up to that point, we were playing just CDs. We were playing just raw CDs from the studio.
Right, right.
And I will tell you that now we were an oldie station. We were like a CBS FM, the first iteration of CBS FM, MJI was. And what I'm saying is I went through 5 different CD versions of Leader of the Pack before the famous Shangri-La song.
Yeah.
Before I found one that was the cleanest.
Oh, so these were different CD versions.
Yes, yes.
But they maybe poorly mastered onto CD.
Poorly mastered. Sometimes you got that Billboard collection, which could be awful.
Yeah. They got it off CART.
I don't know where they got it, but some of that stuff sounded awful. I remember how bad some of the TM Century stuff sounded. Do you remember them? TM Century had an oldies library that they gave out, and they didn't put a lot of care into some of these dubs.
Yeah.
And I would listen to each song that we would have in rotation. I was head of operations at MJI by that time, mm-hmm. and I would listen to every song. I was still a nut on audio.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes they'd be out of phase. Sometimes there'd be no high end, and you'd have to go and find different versions. And often, I remember with Leader of the Pack, we ended up with some German oldies collection or something, and I said, that's the one.
So what surprises me about what you're saying here is, and what is could be sad, is that a lot of stations may not have known that a better copy could exist. Mm-hmm. Like, this is the way I've always heard this song, and so this is how it must be. This is what we're going to play, without even thinking, maybe there's a better copy out there somewhere. So this is pretty interesting. I'm delighted that you found that, hey, I need to check, if it sounds bad, I need to check it out if I can find something better.
Well, that's the number one thing, is source material. That's the number one mistake I think that a lot of programmers make, is they simply accept whatever source material the station has when they arrive at the station. They say, okay, this is the library, and I guess that's it. You've got to go through it and hear it and listen to it, and also listen in mono. Because a lot of these winged out, especially if you have an oldie station or a station that plays classic rock, in the earlier days of stereo, they would wing out the stereo real extreme left, right.
Yeah.
And that doesn't come back in mono very well. And so you've got to make some adjustments there.
Yeah. So, to put that another way, there are processes that different record producers did or different mastering engineers did to widen the stereo image. Not all of those were mono compatible.
Well, I'll tell you, the early days of stereo, many stereo releases that were done in the early days of stereo release mm-hmm. were not meant to be made in stereo. What they were was the original three-track recording where you had, and it wasn't panable, you had a switch left, switch middle, and switch right.
Yeah.
And everything would be way over here or way over there, and maybe the vocal would be in the middle. And when you go back into mono, the real wing outs don't come in, and your modulation goes down. And if you listen in mono, especially, again, with a classic rock or a station that plays some 60s material, the levels are all over the place sometimes because the phasing is different.
So this is the first thing you ask, what's your source material? What do you talk about after that? A program director, again, who says, man, I've got to be – maybe he's blaming his engineer. My engineer doesn't get it. I don't really sound as good as I need to here. What can you do?
Well, the other thing is, what's your format? Okay, I mean, if you're playing to women, mm-hmm. you don't want to have that high end up too high because mm-hmm. that's a turn off to the female ear for the most part. Not to stereotype, but it really is true. And you have to look at what your format is and what is the right processing for the music which you play. Mm-hmm. The other mistake that programmers make is they will switch formats. There'll be a corporate directive or something, and they'll go from being an AC to a hip hop or something, right? And they'll keep the same processing. No.
Well, which reminds me of something. We just put out some PR from Telos Alliance today about Christmas music presets.
Oh, yeah.
Now, why is that important to have different presets for Christmas music?
Because it's the only format in the world where you go from Bing Crosby to Black Sabbath.
Okay, all right. I think my Christmas playlist doesn't include Black Sabbath.
No,
but I get
I
what
mean,
you mean.
I'm
yeah.
being I'm yeah. being a little facetious. I don't know if Black Sabbath has a Christmas song, but you're certainly going from Crosby and Nat King Cole to the Kinks' Father Christmas and to McCartney's Wonderful Christmas Time, which are very, very hotly produced and. You know, you're spanning decades of different audio signature. So you need a really special preset for Christmas music.
Now I want to see if Chris Tobin, you're still there. The station that you are consulting now is a fine arts jazz station, right?
It's a jazz. Yep, curator of jazz music. Absolutely.
So do you change the processing either by day part or by season, maybe for the Christmas season?
No. The program director is quite specific about keeping it consistent, and we don't have to be that aggressive. We are definitely loud, and I will say it's louder than probably more traditional jazz stations, but it's done very very carefully. And there was a talk of trying to do day parting, but it didn't go well. Because, as you know, Denny points out, you have music sources that change, and it changes so much in the jazz world, so it's not worth going crazy trying to figure out which way, because the selection of the music is done by the announcers. It's not pre-programmed, so to speak, like with, say, Selector. So there's no way to do it right. But, you know, the source material is key, so we make sure the source material is pristine as best we can, and that helps me to, how would you say, bring out the very nice punchy feel of jazz music, depending on the song you choose.
You know, one of the interesting things about jazz, and to a large degree classical as well, as opposed to top 40 CHR, AC, hip-hop music, is that in the radio world that I grew up in, and apparently less so in yours, there was one version of the song. Now, there may have been an album version and a single version. We always play the single version. So there was that. That's the only thing you knew. But in the world of jazz, if you want to hear Dave Brubeck and Take Five, one of the most popular songs in the world, you might have 10 different versions of that played at this jazz fest, at that jazz fest, at this dinner club, at this concert. Yeah?
Oh, yeah,
you
absolutely.
Do that in the jazz world, yeah?
Oh, yeah. Matter of fact, recently I heard the three different versions of a Tony Bennett song, and one of them had Lady Gaga with him. And I'm like, okay. So, you know, you can have anything. That's what's great about jazz. You can get away with a lot and still enjoy it. Matter of fact, I heard just recently, it was unbelievable, the James Bond theme to a jazz riff, okay?
Oh,
I mean,
wow.
It was like, wow. And I forget, I don't know, I think it was Yellow Jackets? I forget who did it. But I'm like, okay, that's a new one, got to admit. And it fit right in with the music. I mean, they went segueing from one song to the next. You wouldn't be the wiser. It was great.
Well, and the other thing is sometimes you have fellas that have been around for many years, Louis Prima and mm-hmm. the Duke Ellington Orchestra, people like that, mm-hmm. that have re-recorded their original.
Yeah.
You know, they had the original recording was done in the 40s. Yeah. And then they did it again in the 50s for high fidelity, and then they did it again in the in the late 60s for stereo. So you've got different, you know, the old timers that were around for a long time, you might have three different, they've lived through so many different tech eras that they've redone it for the tech.
Now, back to this question about talking to program directors nowadays, what you're spending some time doing. Mm. So obviously you're wanting to them to, if they're not using an Omnia product, to try one out. Yeah, what are some of the things that you help them understand that they're going to get with a processor designed in the last year or two or three versus one that was designed 10 years ago?
Well, flexibility. The older processors were pretty rigid in their ability to control and sculpt a particular sound. You had it could be this way or this way or this way, and that was pretty much it. Today, modern processors, you can, it's just like have a sculpture with a hunk of clay, and you know, you've got your tools and you can make it any way you want it to be. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, there are presets mm-hmm. because there are some people that either don't have the time or the ability or the desire to do sculpting, and often the presets are good enough. For the very finicky individual, you can go in there and you can really, really sculpt that sound exactly the way you want.
I'm going to make a few minutes of the show a bit of a commercial effort here. One of the most common questions that I get, that other people in this building get, and that you get, and I'm sorry we didn't talk about this beforehand, but it's a question we've talked about before, is what's the difference between the Omnia 9 and the Omnia 11? I got to decide which one I want. And they're designed by different people with fairly different ideas about audio processing. So when that question comes up, what do you tell people?
I tell people that they're both clam chowder. One is New England and one is Manhattan.
Ah.
Which one is better? There is no better. You have to taste each one and tell us which recipe you like better, because one is the 11 is designed by Frank Foti and Cornelius Gould and that crew, and the other, the 9, is developed by Leif Claesson and his crew. And so you have two different chefs with two different recipes, and there is no better or worse. They simply take two different approaches, and it's best you try each one. They're both top-of-the-line processors. Mm-hmm. They're both absolutely the best you can buy. But as far as which one is best for you, you got to taste them.
That's a good answer. I thought it was going to be a cop-out at first, but no, that's a very true answer.
I've been asked that question a couple of hundred times.
And I was just thinking about, you know, I'm in the Nashville market, and I know that there are some hot-sounding stations with an Omnia 11 and some with an Omnia 9, and they're neck and neck, but they are a little bit different.
Yeah, they're different recipes. And you know, that whole clam chowder. They're both clam chowder, But one's New England and one is Manhattan, and there's no better or worse. You taste each one and tell us which one you like.
Now, thinking about audio processing over the years, whenever we come out, whenever the TELUS Alliance comes out with a new product, I usually listen to it. Nowadays, I'm making a video about it. Maybe I was in the past doing a white paper describing about it. And it's always been a progression of improvement all along the way. And then our guy Cornelius Gould came out with this thing called GeForce. That's the blue screen here on the Omnia 11. Mm-hmm. Denny, when I heard that in my office, I had some headphones. No. I had the speakers. I had the speakers on, and I have I probably have 4 dozen songs that I know every tinkle, every note in these songs. I know how they sound. I know how I would prefer them to sound. It's just part of who I am after doing this for 35 years or so. I played them through this GeForce processor, and this is not hyperbole. My jaw, I just sat there slack-jawed for 30 seconds while I'm hearing this, and my thought was, this is how I've always thought that song should sound. Now, what am I hearing with G-Force that gave me that reaction?
Well, it's a number of things, but probably the primary thing you're hearing are instruments and definition that got lost previously. You know, I've heard things through G-Force where I go, I didn't realize there was a little hi-hat cymbal over there. I didn't realize there was a little plunking guitar way over on there. You hear these things that you never heard before, even in songs which you've heard hundreds of times.
Here's that's a very good that makes a lot of sense. I'm sure there's times as engineers listening or watching to the show when you play a song through a system, whether it's on your radio station or in your car stereo or in your home stereo, and it's right. It's really right. This sounds good. You know, your kid's in the backseat playing something through an iPod and some headphones or some horrible Bluetooth speakers, but and that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about, you know, these new speakers, this Macintosh amp or whatever you're using sounds great. And that was my reaction when I heard something through the G-Force. Yeah. I thought it sounded processed. It didn't sound it sounded processed, but I'm thinking like, oh, yeah, oh, I like that. It was an emotional response.
Yeah, it's a big step up, and I don't want to turn this into a commercial, but the only thing I can tell you is we've been doing a lot of outreach on this product. Mm-hmm. The G-Force, of course, is available as an add-on to people who have original Omni 11s, and mm-hmm. the new Omni 11s ship with it standard at no extra charge, and we get the same reaction when I've done outreach and I've told people, you know, when you download the 3.0, the free software update that we have, there's a G-Force demo capability in there. So you can try it and, you know, hear for yourself. And that's all I say. I don't give them a big spiel. I say, go try it. Just go try it. And I tell you, we have somewhere around an 80% stick rate. Hmm. As soon as they hear this thing, suddenly we'll see a purchase order.
I can imagine
and that's okay by me.
I can imagine that the way G-Force sounds maybe isn't right for every format or everybody's ear expectation. But I had Corny on this show some months ago talking about this thing. I've got to save that screen. There we go. This is TV. Stay on. But again, my response to hearing it was emotional. Mm-hmm. And usually I don't get emotional about processing. I'm like, that's good, that's good. Can't make that any louder. It's going to clip a little bit. You know, it's fairly scientific in my ear and my brain are involved. And I heard this G-Force and I go, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Not that there is an answer to that, to my question, why did that happen? Because Corny really couldn't answer either, except that he understands how music ought to be sounding musically, but he also understands that little bit of, you know, give and pump a little bit, and it's just amazing.
Yeah. Well, Corny is a music fan, and he really knows and respects music, and that is at the basis of any audio processing. Frank is that way as well. Yeah. And Frank also is very driven, very determined to make the best possible product on the market. And anybody that knows Frank or has talked with him or has seen his talks can feel the emotion coming out of Frank and the determination that I'm going to make the best damn thing on the market and nobody's going to stop me. And I think some of that goes right into the processor. And Leif is also incredibly driven and finicky about his recipe as well. So we have two master chefs are absolutely just driven to make the best tasting dishes you've ever had.
That's a great way to put it. They're clam chowder from two chefs, and they're both fantastic. But hey, we've got a couple more things to go over, and Chris Tobin will surely have a tip of the week, and you may have a tip also. What would you like? And not right now. We're going to do a commercial first, give you a moment to think about it. What would you like listeners to walk away with from the show? Like, I'm going to try this or that, some technical tip or whatever it may be. We'll get to that. Hey, our show is brought to you by the folks at Axia, and I had a very interesting experience with an Axia user just a couple days ago. Here's a video.
Hey, it's Kirk Harnack with the TELUS Alliance, along with John Nichols here at Kix 92.1, Cleveland, Mississippi. John, you're the morning guy here.
Yeah, that's the allegations.
Don't take offense, but you're an old guy, but you got a new trick behind you here.
Yeah, this is really one of the most functional boards I've ever used because it has everything that you need, no extra. I've worked at radio stations with 32 channels, and you had to hunt for where the phone was. You know, you're using the microphone, you're using the CD input, and a phone, and you got 29 other channels you don't know, so you got to go, where's the phone? This is so easy, no hunting. You don't have to hunt and find where anything is.
Speaking of other stations, you've worked at some big honking stations.
I've worked at US 107 in Nashville. I was mornings and program director there. I worked back in the really early 70s at WMAK, back when it was the number one station in Nashville. Worked at Big Country 1230 in Huntsville back in the later 70s when it was the number one station in Huntsville. I worked mornings in Atlanta and Birmingham. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I've been around.
Yeah. So, now, this console, this little one here only has 6 faders because I was cheap in setting the station up. But is 6 faders enough to do your morning show?
It is perfect. We actually use 3 microphones, mm-hmm. a phone input, and then a computer input, and we've got a production computer. It's everything you need. I mean, exactly what we need.
And you find you're not fumbling around with it. As you said, you don't have to hunt for stuff.
Well, I'm an old guy, so I do a certain amount of fumbling just because of my age. But no, as a matter of fact, and even with the onsets of Alzheimer's, I'm still able to do a show. I don't remember. What were we talking about? Oh, yeah. The faders, yeah.
The Axia Element Console, AOIP technology, perfect for old jocks with Alzheimer's. I'm Kirk Harnack, along with John Nichols at Kix 92.1.
Yeah. Should that be our slogan? Axia, the console for those with Alzheimer's.
He's good. I like him.
Oh, my goodness. Hey, and I'd like to get Chris Tobin to put in a word here, too. Chris, you put in some Axia consoles in very high-pressure environments, not with guys who were kind of semi-retired with Alzheimer's. What was your experience with people being able to execute because the console just worked like you thought it should?
Well, then again, some of the actions of folks I worked with, you could say they had Alzheimer's, but that's another story. I will say that the implementation of the Axia consoles we did at the high-pressured location after we did some research with the announcers worked very well. It worked as advertised. They were quite happy with the way it was functioning, and they were factually amazed at the flexibility of how we could customize it to our particular format, and it worked out well. And I have to say, we, and Kirk, you know this, when we installed it, we had 1, 2, 3, 4 studios, 0 defects, no problems from the day we installed it. We actually did an upgrade of the software while still on the air, and everything worked like it was supposed to. And so I have to say, if you really pay attention to the details, an Axia product will work just fine.
Cool. Well, check it out at our website. Go to telosalliance.com. And then you'll see all the brands. You can click on Axia, and you can see all the different console, from huge consoles down to little bitty ones with 6 faders. You can even make – it's possible to make a 2-fader console. Not sure why you would, but I've seen it at a studio in France. I saw a 2-fader console. It was for the big cheese. He wanted to control his own microphone. It was cool. It worked fine. But my point of that commercial and this message is that, hey – Axia consoles, they're great for the big market stations, but they also work well for small stations. I haven't had to do any maintenance on that console in years, except for a battery replacement on the motherboard. And so that was it, and it's been terrific. Just really. And hey, and John Nichols, if a guy with Alzheimer's can run the console, that's great. It's time for our tip of the week. And Chris Tobin, you always have something that is important and works and good advice. You got something this week?
It's really practical. I was actually doing some work recently and realized that we always forget the obvious. So let's say picture a small area, maybe a newsroom, and you have a four seats, maybe five seats, and the news report is working. So you have what typical setup: an edit console, a computer, a phone hybrid, and things of that sort. Now all of those devices require power. So what happens? You take all those cables, you shove it down behind the cubicle wall and down to the floor and hopefully find a power strip or two that everything is plugged into. However, you've got to do one thing. Label both ends of the cable, the power cable. Why? Well, what happens if you decide to fix the printer and you unplug the computer? Oh, boy, that's a problem. Or maybe you unplug the console. Oh, that's a problem, too. Because maybe you've got to preset the console, make sure you save the settings. So you made some changes, you didn't save it, you power cycle the box, and guess what? The console went back to defaults. So be sure to label both ends. I know it seems crazy, it takes a little extra time, well worth it. So let's use the example. If you don't label that console or the computer cable and you unplug it while the reporter or announcer or music director is using the computer, what happens then? Well, yes, you do reboot the machine. Maybe you hope that the music log is going to come back. Or maybe you hope that the newscaster can write, see a story. Or you can hope that they don't take a swing at you. So which would you prefer? A swing to the head? Or just a simple, oh, look, that's the connector I want to unplug. Think about it. Label your cables. It's very important.
That's great advice. And I would never have thought to do that. Tell me what you use to label. You probably have a Brady labeler. Or do you use something else?
Well, actually, in one location, I did use a Brady labeler. Another location, I bought a sheet of Panduit label, what do you call those? The label stickers. And I just handwrite it. You get the large one, and you just handwrite it on there. Or if you want, you could use a P-Touch, and you fold it over. I've done that,
of course.
It works just fine. Yeah. Or if you fold it over so it's onto itself, that's one way. Or you can just put it horizontally along the wire, and then take clear packing tape and wrap it around once.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so there's ways to do it that don't cost very much. The Brother P-Touch, most people have one of those. If you don't,
that's what I'm saying. That. Yeah. Exactly. But the goal is make the time to label the cable. Trust me, it pays. And I know there's folks out there listening and watching going, oh, yeah, I did get that slap to the head. So, you know, watch out.
Well, I'm the guy that convinced himself, well, I can just tug on one end and see the other. But, hey, sometimes I'll tug on something, and it'll be wrapped around another cable. It'll pull the other cable out of a back of a piece of equipment somewhere. And then
I had that happen to me the other day, working with a couple of people. And I said, hey, let's do this. And they said, well, here it is. This is the cable unplugged. I said, whoa, don't unplug it yet. And it was too late. He said, no, I tugged on it. I said, yeah, and it's wrapped around the power cord to the PC. So I didn't get the slap. He did.
By the way, what is it that if you've got a group of cables that are hidden away somewhere and you don't have clean access to them, that every night do they like do another wrap so that a year later they're in a tangled mess? How does that work?
I think it's part of that theory that Steve Lampin always talks about. It's cable memory. You drop it down behind and slowly goes back to its original form.
Oh, man. It looks more like a cable orgy to me, but, you know, it's just...
Well, this is true. This is true.
I see that they're applauding you there in the bar.
Well, of course. It's this week in Radio Tech. Why not? We always have an applause. Well, so, that other broadcast going on.
Chris, hang on another minute. Denny Sanders has been with us. Denny, have you got a tip or some kind of idea that you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I guess one thing I could say is that we have a pretty extensive support department. Uh-huh. And many of us at the company are ex-broadcasters, and we consider this a kind of fraternity, and we want to encourage people to call support even if they have a question about a product we don't make or a general question about grounding or about acoustics or about anything like that. We got some pretty sharp people in support, and we'd be happy to help you, even if it's got nothing to do with our product and it's just a general question. So, you know, please use our resources. We're here for you.
Good deal. One of the best ways to reach our support department is simply support@telusalliance.com. Mm-hmm. They may be able to answer right away, but you'll certainly go into a queue and they'll get back to you probably as quick as they would have called.
Yeah, it's a pretty quick turnaround.
Yeah.
So did you have any last comments? I appreciate you being here on the show today. That's very nice of you.
My pleasure. And do you have my address so you can send the check that I'm going to get paid for this appearance?
We didn't really talk about this. I don't really budget for that. There's no check.
And the comedy hour now begins.
What?
There's no check.
I'm done.
All right.
Nice. Nicely played. I like that. That is classic. That is great. I haven't seen something like that in ages. That is a classic.
At least he asked at the end of the show instead of at the beginning of the show. This would have been, you know, an hour of you and me again.
That's like a classic Bob Hope, Bing Crosby, Milton Berle. I mean, who else is there? I mean, that is a classic. It's perfect. That is like that is, you know, what some people will say old-time television, but it's perfect, or even radio.
Actually, I don't know when the next play. I don't know the next time I'm going to get Denny back on. I wonder if I could get Denny to come back on stage for a second, because I got a question about pirate radio. Pirate radio in the Netherlands. Now, Denny likes to go occasionally to the trade show in Amsterdam. But even when he can't, there is a radio station that Denny likes to listen to. Oh. I believe it's called Radio...
Oh, Radio Patapo.
Patapo. And we've got like 2-3 minutes.
How much time? Is it three?
Two or three minutes, I'll do it quick. Radio Patapo.
When I was over there, done a few of the shows there, I'm an inherent radio dialer. So I was on my little radio. I'm dialing around one night. Yeah. And I go way up 88.3 in Amsterdam, and there's Radio Patapo, and it's not in any of the logs, and it's obviously a pirate. So I'm listening to this, and it's way out there, way, way out there. All kinds of, like, noise art and you name it. You know.
Noise art.
Yeah, and I've played you some of the videos.
Yeah.
Go to YouTube and type in Radio Patapo, P-A-T-A-P-O-E, and you'll see a couple of guys in the studio making noise art live. You know? And so it's an anything-goes total pirate station. Mm-hmm. I asked the locals, well, where are they from? And they said, well, they're in some squatter's building or something. And I don't know. I have no idea what this is all about. Well, anyway, I think they were taken off the air, but they're still online now.
Didn't you? They were moving around, moving the transmitter from one apartment to another.
Oh, I told you this. Yeah.
From one abandoned building to another.
I told you that we were there for five, 6 days, something. Yeah. And I noticed that every couple of days they would come in a little weaker or come in a little stronger. And I asked around and I said, what's going on? And they said, well, they move the antenna on a like a broomstick or something, and they hang it out of a window and they get the feed from the internet. It's the reverse.
They get
the feed from the net and then they put it on a little transmitter and it's in this building or that building depending on the day, and they're trying to, you know, stay one step ahead of the law. The last couple of times I were there, they were not on FM, so I think they finally got shut down on FM, but they're still online.
Okay.
And it's hilarious. It is just way, way out there. And the other one from Amsterdam that I like is Red Light Radio, which is from the Red Light District. They got a girly window that they put the little control room in. And I have on the telosalliance.com, I did an interview with some of the people that run Red Light. And it's a fascinating, wonderful. Now they aren't as far out as Patapo. Patapo is way out in outer space somewhere, but Red Light is, some good modern, cutting edge rock and some reggae and stuff like that. And they're not a pirate station the way Patapo is, but Patapo is. Just wait. You got to hear this station. It's way out there.
The other interesting thing about the Netherlands is they have pirate radio days. They have this little convention and where all the pirates get together, and they're crazy about audio processing. Mm-hmm. And we've got a developer, Hans van Zutphen, in the Netherlands, and he's developed, I'm sure, plenty of his processors are in the hands of pirate radio operators.
I'll tell you, Patapo, when they were on FM, we had a friend that had a car there, and we drove around. And their audio was – now, bear in mind they're from some dump someplace, you know, squatters, abandoned building. Their audio was very good. On top of that, they had full RDS and complete readout. So they're serious over there. They really are.
Wow. Denny, thanks so much for being with us. I really appreciate it. All right. Denny Sanders here at the Telos Alliance. He's in charge of helping –
broadcasters all around the world sound better, and one of those ways is with Omnia processors. So appreciate him being here. And Denny's, if you want to look him up, he's in the Ohio Broadcast Hall of Fame, the Radio Hall of Fame. So check that out. Chris Tobin, thank you so much for being here from yet another sports bar.
I'm just on location. That's all.
IASB.
See you later, Chris. Do you have a designated driver tonight?
Never do. Sorry, did I say that? No. Yes, I do. I'm fine.
All right. Just remind me to stay away from the streets when it lets out.
No worries. Right. I'm a radio broadcaster. We're professionals when it comes to driving and enjoying a good time.
Chris, can you say can you give a shout to the name of the place where you're at?
Sure. It's Chickies and Pete's in Philadelphia. Everyone knows Chickies and Pete's, crab fries, and the whole rest. It's good. It's good.
Now with, 23 locations or 17 or something like that?
I think it's 22 locations. I've been to 14 of them so far.
Cool.
Really good stuff. But,
hey, next week on This Week in Radio Tech, our guest is Mark Persons. I got to catch up with Mark at the Wisconsin Broadcasters. He is he's a good old guy. You know, he's the solid engineer that can fix your AM directional. And going to look forward to having Mark Persons back on the show next week. And in 2 weeks, we had some tech problems before. We're going to bring him back, though. He's got those solved. He whooped up on the IT department at the university. Dana Popolo will be back with us on December 15th, and he'll be talking about why it's so critical to have proper FM antenna tuning for your transmitter, even if you're a pirate radio station. It's important. So that's all coming up on This Week in Radio Tech. Chris Tobin, thanks for being here. Suncast, thank you very much for producing our show tonight. And thanks to our sponsors, Lavo, at Lavo, LAWO.com, and also Axia at TelosAlliance.com and Axia Consoles, even for guys with Alzheimer's. I'm Kirk Harnack. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye, everybody.